event that might get himself and all his people killed, but the whole project excites him. Like a hunter tracking down a lion in thick underbrush. Dangerous, but what an adrenaline rush. Doug took his leave of the physicist, wishing he could be as fatalistic as Wixon. As he climbed into his tractor and trundled away from the mass driver, heading back toward Moonbase, he tried to see things the way Wixon did. Either the experiment works or we all get killed. Is that the way he really thinks? Or is it that he's so absorbed in the experiment itself that he's not thinking at all about the consequences? Doug's first stop after getting out of his spacesuit and cleaning it was the control center. Everything looked normal in the big, dimly lit room. The quiet hum of electronics. Rows of consoles monitored by men and women staring at the screens, pin mics at their lips and earphones clamped to their heads. A controlled intensity, with the big electronic wall displays that showed schematics of the entire base looming over all of them. He saw Ginny Anson bending over the shoulder of the chief communications technician. Walking over to her, he asked, "What's up, Ginny?" She straightened up, and Doug saw that her face was somber. "A lot of activity at L1, she said, gesturing toward the Comtech's center screen. Doug saw a radar plot of the space station that hovered nearly 60,000 kilometers above them. Several additional blips clustered around the red dot marking the station. Resupply? Doug mused. Not likely, said Anson. Their regular resupply run took place on schedule last week. No, they're delivering something to the station, but it's not life support supplies or propellant. Doug took in a deep breath. The nuclear missile? Maybe more than one. For a moment, Doug was silent, thinking. Then he said, I'm going to call Harry Clemens. It's time to pop an observation satellite so we can keep an eye on Nippon 1. Anson nodded, then grinned ruefully. You might not like what you see, boss. Gordette was sitting in the cave, nursing a mug of the stuff that passed for coffee at Moonbase. It was midday, and the cafeteria was filling up with the lunchtime crowd. But no one sat at Gordette's table. No one came near it. A ring of empty tables surrounded him. Pariah, he said to himself. That's the word. For days he'd been trying to recall the term. At last it came swimming up from his subconscious. Pariah. Outcast. Murderer. Assassin. That's me, and they all know it. It would have been better if Doug had let me die, Gordette told himself. He says he trusts me, but none of these others do. They all know about me now, or they think they do, and they all hate me. Then he saw Paula Leibowitz carrying a tray in both hands, making her way through the crowded tables, heading straight toward him. She walked with a determined stride and an odd, tenacious expression on her face, right up to Gordette's table.
"Do you mind if I sit here?" she asked, almost truculently.
Gordette spread his arms to take in all the empty chairs. Be my guest. Leibowitz plopped her laden tray on the table and took the chair next to Gordette.
Is it true? Did you really try to kill Doug Stavanger?
Gordette couldn't make out what was in her eyes. It wasn't anger, exactly, but it wasn't tenderness, either. It's true, he said flatly.
You're a hired assassin? A hitman?
He puffed out a sigh. When I first met you, I was trying to sabotage Doug's suit.
Son of a bitch, Leibowitz said.
She wasn't calling Gordette a name, he realized, merely expressing her emotions. He tried to shrug. That's what I was sent here to do.
And when you invited me to dinner, that was part of it? You were going to try to use me to help you kill Stavanger?
No, he answered slowly. I invited you to dinner because I liked you.
Yeah. Sure.
Even trained assassins need some human companionship now and then, Gordette told her.
Don't try to make a joke out of this.
It's no joke, believe me.
Why should I believe anything you say?
Why do you ask me, then?
I liked you, Leibowitz said. I was even thinking about going to bed with you.
Get your kicks with a black man, huh? She frowned with puzzlement.
What?
I'm black.
And I'm a Jew. What's that got to do with anything?
Gordette thought it over for a moment. Nothing.
Nothing's got anything to do with anything. What's that supposed to mean? I don't know, he said, getting irritated with her cross-examination. So I liked you and you liked me, so what? Stavanger's letting you stay here? You're still working with him? Cordette nodded. He trusts you? After you tried to kill him? I told him the story of my life, Cordette said, acid in each word, and he decided he's going to reform me. Start me a new life here on the moon, where everybody loves me and trusts me. Yeah, you've made it so easy to be loved and accepted. The only thing I've made easy is being black, so you can spot me at a distance. What the hell's this black business got to do with it? You see any other black people up here? Leibowitz almost laughed at him. My supervisor's black. There's dozens of Afro-Americans and blacks from other countries here. She turned in her chair and pointed. Look, black people and Asians. Hell, they even let Italians up here. Very funny. The first American astronaut on Mars was black. Big deal. Stop feeling sorry for yourself. Okay, good advice. I'll do that, he mumbled. Leibowitz glared at him like a disappointed mother. You really tried to kill him? I slit his throat. All right? Is that what you wanted to hear? My fucking confession? He said it loudly enough so that people at the nearest tables turned to stare at him. What I want to hear, Leibowitz said, her voice low, is where you're going from here. Straight to hell, Cordette said. So you're going to isolate yourself, build a wall, and not let anybody near you. He pointed to the ring of empty tables around them. You see anybody trying to make friends with me? I am, she said. He blinked, uncomprehending. I'm having lunch with you, aren't I? Leibowitz said. Maybe you can tell me the story of your life and make me believe that you're something more than just a hired killer. Space Station Masterson. Like a growing frontier town, Space Station Masterson had succumbed to urban sprawl, but now it was starting to look like a ghost town. Orbiting some 250 miles above the Earth, at first glance Masterson looked like a disconnected conglomeration of odds and ends, a junkyard floating in space. The modules where personnel were housed spun lazily on opposite ends of 3-kilometer-long carbon filament tethers, like oversized aluminum cans glinting in the sunlight, connected by strings so thin and dark they were for all practical purposes invisible. The modules formed a huge, disjointed wheel more than 10 kilometers in circumference, with the tethers as spokes. Outside the circumference of the habitation module's arc floated the factories, labs, repair shops, and transfer center, their angular utilitarian shapes dwarfed by huge wings of solar panels and radiators, massive concave solar mirrors that collected and focused the sun's heat for smelting and other processing work, and forests of antennas and sensors, all in zero gravity or the nearest thing to it. Like most of the major complexes in permanent Earth orbit, Masterson was a combination of several purposes. Part manufacturing facility, part scientific research laboratory, part observation platform, part maintenance and repair center, and part transfer station for people and cargo heading onward to Moonbase. There was even a tourist hotel module twice the size of all the others. Since the UN imposed embargo on Moonbase traffic, however, there were no transfers of people heading out to the moon, and no arrivals of lunar cargo carriers. The manufacturing facility had shut down for lack of raw materials. No lunar transfer vehicles needed maintenance or repair. They were all hanging silent and useless in weightless geodesic cocoons that protected them from incoming radiation and the occasional meteoroids that peppered cislunar space. The tourist hotel was still running, but its business had dropped off sharply since the war against Moonbase had started. Jill Myers gazed sadly through an observation port in the hotel module. She had helped to build Masterson back in the days when she'd been a government astronaut. She was accustomed to seeing space-suited figures bustling from module to module, jetting along in solo maneuvering units, or riding